Good evening, one and all. Nice full house tonight. Everybody back from holidays and all that, I presume. It's good to have you all. We have, believe it or not, almost only 3 days short of a whole month between this lesson and the last time that we thought about Joseph. So we had, you know, a meeting and holidays. We also had a fourth Sunday. So in the evening, all that time given over to a song and prayer. So it's been a whole month. And so I just want to point out a couple of things before we get back into lessons to be learned from the life of Joseph. And number one, of course, Joseph spent the vast majority of his life in the land of Egypt. He was but a teenager when his brothers hated him for the gift of prophecy that God had given to him, and bringing back the bad report probably as well. And so he, at a very, very young age, is torn away from his family. He will wind up going through quite a number, of false accusations and wind up in jail and all that sort of thing. And so we're familiar with the life of this man. Most people, I think, probably don't realize, though, that these pyramids are of such vast age that when Abraham sojourned for a brief while in Egypt about 1900 BC and hundreds of years before Joseph, those things were already standing. When Joseph was taken into captivity, they were standing. When Moses showed up, they'd been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. So here they still tower over that land and are symbolic, in a way, of the problems that the Jews have had on numerous occasions in their history, with Egypt. But in Joseph's case, suffering as he did initially, we know, of course, he came to be the second in command in that great country. So we saw the life of Joseph in the first lesson. It would have been about 6 weeks ago, I guess. And then, just about a month ago, we had a lesson that really had very little to do with Joseph himself per se. And that's going to be the case, not with that lesson only, but in the lessons that are to come. We're following, as you may remember, a book that was written by Don Bassett, Jerry's brother. And in that book, of course, you have the facts about the life of Jesus. And what he's done, though, is taken then lessons that we can see are exemplified in the life of Joseph. Did I say Jesus a moment ago in the life of Joseph? And then springboarding off of them to other passages that will deal with the same thing. So while this is about, a book and loosely following the outline of the Joseph Code, there's not all that much material about the life of Joseph, historically at least, that we'll be looking at from this point on. So, as I began the last lesson a month ago, I wanted to do exactly the same thing tonight. Some of the verses, I thank Frank for reading the entire context, and we're going to focus on just verses 17 through 19 now. But in Psalm 105, we learn something that is not told in Genesis in the historical record of Joseph's life. It says, he sent a man before him, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. We had that much in Genesis. But then it says, they afflicted his feet with fetters. He himself was laid in irons until the time that his word came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. So what that last line means is that throughout those years and until the time that the prophecies in the visions that God had given to Joseph, two of them that got him in so much trouble, first with his brothers and then with his parents as well, that until that was to come to pass, which would be a very long period of time, and the famine that would eventually drive the family to seek help in Egypt, and eventually Joseph would reveal himself to them. But throughout all of this time, the word of the Lord was testing Joseph. And that's the theme for the lesson tonight. We're all of us familiar with the life of Joseph. We know that he had a lot of trials. We see those problems. But perhaps, and until you read Psalm 105, verse 19, we don't appreciate that throughout all of that, it was not just the unhappy accident, of his life. God was behind every bit of it, and it was not just, I suppose we could say, that God was setting up, decades later, to save the Jews. That's not the case alone. God was testing Joseph. God had, for his own purposes, reasons to be causing this man to go through those fiery trials that he had to endure. Now, our purpose tonight, and what I do is I take a look at Don's book, see the information that he provides with each of these lessons, and then I go and add to that or change that or rearrange that or whatever, you know, in my own studies. So what we're going to do tonight is look just at verses, just a few of the verses in the Scriptures, both Old and New Testaments, that speak of why God tests anybody. Testing is profoundly important, and as passionately as we know how, we try to avoid it. We really don't want any part of any kind of suffering, of any kind of trial. When you're set in circumstances that are difficult, that are painful, that involve loss, you know, whenever you're challenged by something, it's uncomfortable. It's discomforting. It's not a thing that we desire. Jesus himself taught us to pray that we be not led into temptation. So certainly we don't want any additional temptation than what is necessary. We don't want to suffer in any way if we can avoid it. But what we'll find out tonight, and we certainly see in the life of Joseph, is that it is necessary under certain conditions and for certain purposes. So we're just simply going to go through a number of slides now. I've put all of the verses tonight on the screen, so you'll be able to see them there. But as you take your notes and jot this information down, each of these will have some unique statement about why it is that God did that to Joseph. What did Joseph ever do? Why would he have to go through that? You know, we don't read anything about his terrible failures or great sins or anything. He's just a teenager, and he was doing everything right. What criticism do we have in any of the historical record of Joseph? There's just absolutely none. So why is God having him, you know, treated like this? It's not just to save the Jews when the famine comes. So we're going to start with Exodus, and of course, therefore, Moses. This is chapter 15, verses 23 through 26. I will have to sometimes use some fairly small print to squeeze it all onto a single slide, but it's Exodus chapter 15, verses 23 through 26. When they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah, which you can probably deduce means bitter. So it just bore the name. It was bad water. It just didn't taste good, and it was so foul that you couldn't even drink it at all. But in 24, the people grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Then he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. He threw it into the waters. The waters became sweet. There he made for them a statute and a regulation. And there he what? There he tested them. It's not just happenstance. They were led there by God. This is where God wanted them to go. God knew the waters were bitter. God knew they weren't going to be able to drink them. It's not hardly Moses' fault, and yet the people are grumbling against Moses, and everybody is being tested. It's one of the miracles we study in our Sunday morning class in the 26 lessons that we concluded this morning, in that he simply takes a tree, tosses it in the waters, and instantaneously, they're sweet as can be, healthy as can be, everybody drinks. It's a miracle. But in verse 26, we've just been told he's testing them. He said, "If you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God, and do what is right in his sight, and give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians. For I, the Lord, am your healer." And by the way, I might just mention, there's a very famous book, older book now. I have no idea if it's still in print, though likely not. But if you can track down, if you'd like to hunt, you know, the internet for books, you know, used books and rare books and that sort of thing, maybe it's still available, I'm not sure. But there's a book called None of These Diseases that has been very famous in Christian circles for maybe 100 years. Really an interesting read. And he makes the point that God is testing them here about these waters. What does He want them to do? He wants them to trust Moses, because Moses is only doing what God is asking them to do. They're out there in the wilderness because God freed them from slavery. It is in accord with His plan. But it is a test. He brought them up to see how they would respond when they were thirsty and they couldn't drink. How would they react? After He is testing them in this manner, He's explaining to them, if you give heed to the Lord, if you do what is right, if you give ear to His commandments, if you keep all His statutes, you'll never have the diseases that the Egyptians are suffering from. I'm trying to bless you. I'm trying to teach you that I will take care of you. I brought you here to show you this. You should have just said, okay, Moses, what will God do next? All you had to do was go in prayer and ask me to take care of you. Instead, they failed this test. They grumbled against Moses. So He uses the occasion of their failure to say to them, I would free you from all the diseases and problems that you had in Egypt and that the Egyptians themselves are suffering from. Next time I test you is the suggestion, then what? Grin and bear it. Wasn't that a Reader's Digest segment? I remember years. I think they called it Grin and Bear It. There'd be a little joke about it. Grin and bear it. Brethren, is there anything in this life that is of such significance that we should ever harden our hearts against God because of it? If your house burns down with your family in it, well, that's a terrible thing. It's about as bad as anything I can imagine. And maybe you're scarred for life and crippled, you know, why me? And all those kinds of things. Can it compare with an eternity in heaven where you don't even have a body? No. So what they're supposed to be learning in a little bit of thirst, and we ought to be able to carry with us into the most horrific circumstances imaginable, is this lesson. If you'll give heed, if you'll do what's right, if you'll give ear to His commandments, if you'll keep all His statutes, He will put none of these diseases on you. He was taking them to a promised land, promising to free them from these things. But ultimately, brethren, how much disease is there in heaven? There's just none. There aren't going to be these problems if we can just learn to stiffen our backs, face forward, lean on in, and get the job done while we're a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. The reward will come. Next is just five chapters later, verses 18 through 20 and chapter 20. So Exodus 20, 18 through 20. All the people perceived the thunder, the lightning flashes, the sound of the trumpet, the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at a distance. What is the occasion? Moses will be receiving the Ten Commandments. Now 19, they said to Moses, speak to us yourself. We will listen. But let not God speak to us. All this we see in verse 18, scaring us, you know, just to death. Or we'll die. We don't want to be anywhere near this mountain anymore. In verse 20, Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. God has come in order to test you, in order that the fear of Him may remain with you, so that you may not sin. Now, brother, for most of us, I know it's certainly true for me, and it was kind of a wake-up call for me in doing these studies, and I got to look at that verse, like, you know, I've just really kind of missed that, I guess, all these years. That's an interesting lesson. Why did God appear on that mountain with fire and smoke, lightning and thunder, and scare the people so bad they thought they were going to die, and they begged Moses to just flee back out into the desert? We don't even want to be here anymore. Well, Moses says, God has come in order to test you. God has appeared here on this mountain in this form for the very purpose of causing you to fear Him. But it's in order that the fear may remain with you, that you may not sin. They were supposed to be learning in this test, and by their fear, that they ought to fear and carry that fear from then on. Now, brother, today we don't have smoking mountains. I appreciate that. We do have, though, what we know so well, both the first and second chapters of the Roman letter, no excuse when we behold what is created to appreciate the power of our God. Could that smoking mountain have been any more impressive than our sun? Which, thanks to our advanced technology now, we've come to know an awful lot about. It's a good bit bigger than the whole Sinai Peninsula, let alone the mountain. That sun. And what it's doing up there is a good deal hotter than what those people were experiencing down there. God really toned it down and let the mountain stand. Okay. But he also had turned it up on them in the form of the test. I want you to recognize that when you're in my presence, you should be humble. You should recognize my power and be afraid of it, for I will judge you. And this power that God wields, he is able then to use either against us or for us. So you're being tested that you'll fear the Lord. Now, for poor Joseph, you know, he's seeing all these kinds of things. Ultimately, he winds up, I think, probably more than ever, fearing God when he becomes, you know, second only to Pharaoh. That'd be kind of a scary thing. A lot of responsibility, as a matter of fact, just to begin with, but also to recognize the power that God had and wielded throughout all of those years. So, what was happening when God appeared on the mountain? Moses got 10 commandments. Well, yeah. The people were really afraid. Yeah. And God did that on purpose so they would carry that awestruck memory with them the rest of their lives as a motivator to avoid sin. Next time you look in the night sky, think about that. Just moments ago, before the class started, I think it was Carol and I were talking, you know, about the ambient light, you know, of cities. You saw this morning that slide of Italy and Sicily and then Malta and all that. And it was a nighttime satellite shot. You saw how illuminated that everything was. You know, and I mentioned to her that people that sail or take ocean voyages will come back telling tales, you know, that when you're out in the far reaches of the ocean and finally you get away of all this massive amount of light that we've created artificially, and you look up into those skies, you really get the full, fearsome reality of God's power. One day we will face him in judgment. Pass the tests now. Be ready then. Deuteronomy chapter 8 comes to the end of Moses' life. Of course, he will die very shortly on the Jordanian side of the Jordan River, of course, there by Mount Nebo. And in chapter 8, verses 16 through 18, as he is recapping all of his life and 120 years and these last 40 that he's been with them in the wilderness, he says in verse 16, "In the wilderness he fed you manna, which your fathers did not know." Nobody had ever eaten manna before. Do they ever eat it again? No. "He did that he might humble you and that he might test you to do good for you in the end." The reception of the manna was a test. And this one particularly opened my eyes as I was preparing this lesson. Otherwise, think about the manna. Otherwise, you may say in your heart, "My power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who is giving you power to make wealth, so that he may confirm his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day." They had 40 years of manna. Then they crossed the Jordan from Mount Nebo, entered into a land flowing with milk and honey, and did they ever see it again? Gone for good. That's over. But if God had not been demonstrating them daily his miraculous power, deeply impressing them with their utter helplessness in the wilderness, if they'd gotten through 40 years in the wilderness without God's divine help, well, now that is some kind of accomplishment. And now it's not "look at me because I humbly serve my God as faithfully as I know how." It would be, "I'll tell you what, we are some kind of great people, aren't we? Who else could do what we did? We spent 4 decades in the Sinai Peninsula, and here we are conquering, you know, the promised land. The manna kept them alive. But what does this passage say was a major feature daily, 6 days a week, for the manna? So that they would not say in their heart, my power, the strength of my hand made me this wealth. God is caring for you. Now, it was curious and embarrassing people maybe here tonight, but I got a letter from Josh Hebert asking me four questions about prayer and what, it, you know, specifically were some of the answers that I'd seen to prayer. I wrote back, it's kind of hard to tell sometimes, but in this one, we could sure see a lesson, can't we? Were they to be praying in the wilderness? Were they to ask God to feed them, to bless them with water? Yes, they were. And in their case, the very presence of the manna was also to humble them and impress them with their utter helplessness and dependence upon God. Are we any less dependent today? What did Jesus say about how hard it is to get into the kingdom for wealthy people? Is there any people that has ever been as wealthy as a nation as we are? Great trial, great temptation. Maybe we can remember that every one of these is a gift from our God. Now I put these next two together, Psalm 17 verse 3 and Psalm 26 verses 1 through 3, because they both have the Psalms of David similar thoughts. Psalm 17, 3 says, You have tried my heart, you have visited me by day, you have tested me, and you find nothing. I have purposed that my mouth will not transgress. David adds to this in 26, the first three verses, vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity. I have trusted in the Lord without wavering. Examine me, O Lord. Try me. Test my mind and my heart. For your loving kindness is before my eyes, and I have walked in your trusts. I just wanted us to see in these two passages, here is a man so confident in his faith and in his performance, that not in arrogance by any means, and certainly not challenging God, but he invites the test. Vindicate me, test me. I have been what you've asked me to do. Now, brethren, hopefully, and we've touched on this not too distant past, I think it's tremendously important that we try to acquire this spirit to be able to balance that fearless confidence that I know who I am. I know that I am serving my God as best as I know how. I have every confidence and faith that God is well pleased in me, and not be arrogant and think that I did it with my own power like Nebuchadnezzar, whereas was feared in the preceding verses. We are to love others as we love ourselves. We are to come before the throne of God, Hebrews 4, boldly. We are to be a people who judge righteous judgment. We are supposed to be a people who do not think more highly of ourselves than we ought to think. Now, there's four verses all in a row just like that. What are they all about? They're about knowing who you are. No sin, no conceit, no arrogance, no snooty nose in the air looking down at everybody else, no, judgments and criticisms that you're passing on everybody, but knowing in your heart of hearts, are you a faithful servant of God or not? Yes. So there's an interesting one here that does not speak necessarily of the test coming upon the individual itself, but David saying, go ahead, I'm ready, I can pass that test. Now, when you think, though, Abraham, Joseph, Moses, in that order, and now David, if ever there was a man who really spent a lifetime undergoing testing, who was it? It's David. This guy suffered like very few people, and Job's got nothing on David. And so this is a man who's been through those tests and perhaps comprehends the lessons we've seen in the previous ones. Hopefully, and I have no doubt, Joseph is learning these same things. Joseph knows he did not commit the sin that Potiphar's wife accused him of. Joseph knows that he didn't get into captivity in the first place because he made up these visions. Joseph knew who he was, and in fetters and in bonds, until the word of those prophecies can be fulfilled. Apparently, did he ever fail a test? I can see Joseph praying those two prayers. You tried my heart, you visited me by night, you've tested me and you find nothing. I've purposed, my mouth will not transgress. Vindicate me, I walked in my integrity, I trusted in the Lord. Examine me, try me, test me and my heart, mind and heart. Your loving kindness is before me and I've walked in your truth. Go lay your head on your pillow tonight. Pray that prayer. Yeah, you wouldn't be here tonight if you didn't share in that spirit. Here's one. In Jeremiah 17, very familiar, I think, you know, with this first part. The heart is more deceitful than all else and is desperately sick. Who can understand it? That's typically, you know, many Christians, you know, high on their list of favorite verses. Trying to help, we use this to help other people to understand. You can't just trust yourself above the writings of Scripture. We've got to be so very careful to recognize we'll deceive ourselves. We'll trip our own selves up. We'll rationalize and justify ourselves, and we can argue that case, we think, before the Supreme Court of ourselves. You know, we always get the judgment in favor of ourselves when we're the judge, don't we? You win every case. But the heart is exceedingly deceitful. You know, the old joke. If you try to be your own lawyer, then you have what for a client? You have a fool for a client if you're your own lawyer. Because the heart's exceedingly, it's desperately sick. Who could understand it? But then he says, in verse 10, on the Lord's part, I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the mind, even to give to each man according to his ways, according to the results of his deeds. This ties your reward. Brethren, I have no doubt, in this life and after this life, ties it very proportionally to how you do with the tests. He gives to each one according to their ways, according to the results of their deeds, when the Lord is searching your heart and testing your mind. Joseph is our perfect example. He's a teenager, but he lives faithfully. He passes one test, he passes the next test, he passes every test. He spends a lifetime in service. And where does he find himself? In Egypt, as he looks out at the pyramids. In his day, already several hundred years old, so they were still shiny then. When you look at those things, he was in charge of those things. He could have given the order, brethren, to build another one. Imagine such power. But he was rewarded, wasn't he? According to the results of his deeds when he passed the test. So the next time you're feeling, you know, like things aren't going well and I don't have enough in life, you know, and all those sorts of things, at least let the thought flip through your mind that maybe you don't deserve them either. Now, that thought must have gone through Joseph's mind when he was young, but he stayed the course and he passed the test, and in the end, he had more than anybody could imagine. So might we in this life, and so surely will we in the life to come. In James chapter 1, two more verses, and we'll bring this to a close. In James chapter 1, this will be probably the one that immediately comes to mind, the most familiar to us about testing. Verses 2 through 4, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials. Now remember Psalm 105, wearing fetters and all the way, you know, 1,000 miles to Egypt and all the trouble he had. I don't know if it's a full 1,000 miles. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces, endurance. Let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So when you lay your head tonight and you pray David's prayer, Lord, test me, I'm faithful, I've done everything you want, you can't find anything against me. Okay? And then pray this one too. I'm ready for more testing, so that it will perfect me. I would be complete and lacking in nothing, Lord. I am ready for the next level, for the next step, if it be your will. And then we'll close. One last verse is 1 Peter chapter 4, verses 12 through 19. It's the lengthiest one of the entire series. Beloved, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing. That's not supposed to be surprising, as though some strange thing were happening to you. Brethren, the two words, why me, are all about you thinking, well, this is a strange thing, it's inappropriate, it's wrong. Brethren, don't be surprised. They shouldn't be in the first century, and they've suffered more than we do, which comes upon you for your testing. That's what it's for. As though some strange thing were happening to you, but to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ. That kind of sends a little shiver up my spine when I think about that. I know how Jesus suffered. To what degree do any of us share in the sufferings of Christ? Are we carrying the guilt of the world upon our sinless shoulders? Are we spending our lives preaching and teaching and being threatened, you know, to cast off a cliff in the very town I grew up in? Are we going through anything like Jesus did that then brought him to the cross and went through that? But 13, to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. If you're reviled for the name of Christ, you're blessed, because the Spirit of glory in God rests on you. You can't be reviled unless you're getting the job done. The Spirit of glory and of God rests on you, or the world wouldn't be coming at you the way that they are. Make sure none of you suffers as a murderer or a thief or evildoer or troublesome meddler. But if anyone suffers as a Christian, he's not to be ashamed. It is to glorify God. But he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. For it's time for judgment. It's not now. This is back then. But it's time for judgment upon them at that time to begin with the household of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? If it's with difficulty the righteous is saved. Brethren, is it with difficulty that the righteous are saved? It's a simple statement of fact. Are you righteous? Smile humbly and say yes. I am. That's your goal. You're succeeding at it. Again, your presence proves it. If it's with difficulty the righteous are saved, what will become of the godless man and the sinner? Eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord. 2 Thessalonians 1. Therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. You will never come to the pinnacle of your relationship with Christ until you suffer the furthest extent of the agonies this world can offer. That's the point of 19. First, we're going to share, and then those who suffer according to the will of God entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. When you're utterly helpless, when you're utterly crushed, when you're absolutely without any more you can do and you're suffering the worst, you know you can't do it yourself. You entrust your soul to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. And you learn something about faith you're not going to get any other way. Now Joseph is the perfect example of all these things. So we know the story of his life. We know he passed every test, and he learned every one of these lessons, apparently. And these are the lessons from this class. Passing God's tests results in fantastically wonderful rewards. And it's worth the cost. Tests produce fear, respect for God, which he intends for us to carry always, that we might not sin. Tests cause us to trust in God and not in ourselves. thinking we can handle everything. Passing God's tests gives us great confidence, like David's, to say, Lord, so far as I know, I'm doing exactly what you want me to do. That's how we all should pass through this life. Number five, our reward is proportionate to the tests that we pass. And you can't be tempted beyond what you're able. So what is God doing with every temptation and trial and test that comes your way as they get progressively worse, and you're thinking they should be getting progressively less? They're getting worse because they're doing what? They are increasing your reward. It's proportionate to your service. Number six, testing produces perfection in James and causes us to share in the very sufferings of Christ, which once again turns our hearts to God alone, who can save and protect us. I almost wish Joseph hadn't lived, because now I got to go through some of the stuff he did. And he set the standard pretty high, didn't he? So, we see it lived in his life in Genesis, and then we have lesson after lesson after lesson after lesson, Old Testament and New, to explain this phenomenon, which Abraham went through, Joseph followed him, Moses after that, David, all the rest, down to today. Can you do it? Yes. Can you grow, improve, be better? Yes. Will your reward grow, improve, and be better? Absolutely. Brethren, to the work. If we can help you in some particular regard, prayer, Bible study, ready perhaps even this evening to be baptized into Christ, let it be known, please. Just come forward and speak with me as we sing.